On today's show, Pendle Town Council goes looking for more money for more trails, an Ontario elementary school goes pro-life, and we check in on the health of the Canadian Charter as it turns 40 this year. This is Pendle Talk Radio. And welcome back to the show. Thank you for coming back and joining us this week. My name is Brian Constein. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
And thank you for joining us, like I said, and congratulations for surviving. Of course, the first sign of a good Alberta spring is a solid snowstorm.
That was quite the dump of snow we got. That was heavy snow, like it was just weighing everything down.
Yeah, this is West Coast snow. This is kind of the snow that I was familiar with when I was growing up. Congratulations for surviving the Alberta spring snowstorm. This is just a friendly reminder. Don't forget about the May long snowstorm. So just don't put away the shovels yet.
It's not over until the end of May.
Yeah. And then of course the other sign of spring, is the yard waste bins are back in town. So the town is making sure that everyone knows where you can dump your lawn clippings that you've unearthed from the snow and then chopped up and put in bins and the rain over there.
I've got my fair share of stuff I got to gather from my yard that's been accumulating, and the yard bins is just another reminder I should probably get on it.
I'm not big on yard work. Like I like, to me, just as long as I can keep the grass under, say, bylaw regulation, I'm happy. Yeah. We started out with a decent kind of garden in our backyard. It's now all lawn. So I'm not the big yard guy. I have to go talk to Mayor Mueller about that. I think oh, I have any inside information.
No,
there's no inside plot.
This isn't a hint or a tip or something.
Oh no, I've just ruined his reelection chances. He's got like 3.5 years to overcome this gaffe. No, Councillor Mueller, I think, has a little more of a green thumb than I do. Though I guess I can probably say that for almost anybody. No, Councillor Mueller, not mayor. Mayor Yarjot, you're still safe. All right. Moving beyond that, quickly. Let's get a recap of the news of the week, or at least news that, you know, we found interesting. So first, and this just came to my attention just before we started recording, in Red Deer News Now, they have an article headlined, Penhold applying for $1.6 million grant to expand trail system. And so this is, so at the last council meeting, the council put a request in for this grant. And the idea is that this would provide funding that would go to help fill out the building and construction of the community hub.
Yeah, it'll all tie in together to really, really kind of wrap up that long-term project of trying to get that recreational area completed.
Yeah, and so this is apparently it's a 60-40 funding application. So the town would put up 40%, and then the federal government would put in there 60%. So on the town side, it would look like $600,000, and then another $1 million would come in from the feds. And so some things that it would be kind of earmarked for in this article, it says that if the active transportation grant is accepted, it will be applied towards further connectivity of 13 trails around 6 kilometers worth throughout town. It would help to fund the footbridge to allow access from east to west of the waterway. And in case you're not sure what the waterway Pendle is.
Really sounds a lot more impressive than it is, but
yeah. It's just the ponds that are kind of to the southeast of the multiplex. Yeah. So there'd be a footbridge that would go from the west side of that all the way to the east side. Or maybe from the east to the west. I think both will be okay. But that's the footbridge. That's the Penhold waterway. And they're going to, the funding would also go for an aeration system in those ponds, a boat dock for fishing and kayaking, and then lighting for the trails. And so hopefully they get all that. And as we've kind of mentioned, this project, they're And in this article, it says that their construction is expected to begin this spring. So within weeks, I would suspect.
The town has hopes of having this completely finished before Fall Festival. So it's ambitious, but very ambitious, I think they're really, really hoping to get this wrapped up and not turn it into a long awaited project.
It'd be nice to get some trails in there. The big plan, I guess, would be to have a trail system all the way from Penhold into Red Deer, or even Penhold into Innisfail. I've always admired the trail system that goes alongside the road. I think it's a Gull Lake there. Benalto, Alberta. Is Alberta Beach or Gull Lake? Or maybe it's all the same area, but it's that Benalto stretch there. I forget what highway it is.
Yeah.
But they've always had that huge, it just seems like it goes on forever and ever, that trail system. So that'd be kind of maybe after they get this done, if they are running out of projects to do, this might be another one to kind of refocus effort on.
That gets tricky because of being such a collaborative project. You're looking at counties and municipalities, and everybody kind of has to work together to make it actually tie in, or you have trails that go to a dead end.
Yeah. The worst part would probably be, it would probably require the province to get involved, because you're probably putting pathways along
by highways
there. But you got another 3.5 years of council, maybe
they can work something out.
They can, look at this. They're almost done everything on their list. And then they need something to do now for the next 3 years. There's something, at least, who knows. All right. So that's local news. Moving out east in Ontario, here's another headline, and we'll see how much trouble we can get in with this article here. The article is from CBC News, and the headline reads, "Mom furious grade 8 students at Woodstock, Ontario school must make posters for anti-abortion groups contest." And then it says, "The posters will be made at Woodstock school, will be graded, entered in the Right to Life Coalition contest." Now, if you were reading this, and my first impression was, wow, I'm kind of surprised that there's a school running an anti-abortion or / pro-life contest.
Yeah, my first question is, what school is this?
I know, what? This is Canada? this cannot be right. There's something up here. And yes, in the very first sentence after that provocative headline, it says, "An Ontario Catholic school is under fire for a grade 8 assignment that requires students to make anti-abortion." I'm going to rephrase that always, pro-life posters for marks and the chance to win a cash prize. The assignment at St. Patrick Catholic Elementary School in Woodstock involves students creating a poster that includes the words "Unborn Babies Matter," along with a picture or pictures that incorporate the theme. The in-class assignment is being graded and entered into a contest run by a local anti-abortion group. Again, this is CBC's framing of what this group is. And so, basically, this is a Catholic school teaching Catholic beliefs, yeah. I'm thinking. And even, and so this whole kerfuffle, this fire that the school is under, was prompted by a parent of a student who's in the Catholic school. And she says that, "I understand it's a Catholic school and it teaches Catholic beliefs, but we're living in a day and age where women's rights matter. With everything going on in the world, I don't think these kids have to have this added on top of it." Now, there's a lot of different points in this article. Not to get into it too deep, the only point I really want to highlight is that are we really at a stage of society in which we are surprised that Catholics are teaching Catholic things?
Yeah, at one point it says that she's pulling her kids out of the Catholic school over an in-class anti-abortion assignment. Well, good. Go put your kids in a school that aligns with your beliefs.
Yeah.
Are you surprised when you sent your kids to a Catholic school that they might just teach something that comes from Catholic belief?
There are certain things that have happened in kind of the realm of Catholicism recently that would make me think or be a little surprised that they're actually teaching this, but they haven't abandoned all of their core central beliefs. And so, yeah, if you send your student to a Catholic school, don't be surprised that they're going to be taught Catholic things. Like this whole sanctity of life thing, like this is a long-term belief. This isn't something they've picked up recently, say in the last 500 years. Like this is a long time ago.
Yeah.
And this project says that students in the class are learning the Catholic Church's view on the sanctity of life as part of the grade 8 religion curriculum, and are given a poster assignment to complete on the topic, said Mark Atkinson, a spokesperson for the London District Catholic School. So exactly, this is in a grade 8 religious class at a Catholic school.
In a Catholic school, yeah.
So I don't see where the controversy is in here. Of course, the article goes on to highlight more and more that, you know, there really should be a debate involved, that the school should be provide both sides of the argument. And quite frankly, I don't go for it. Like the pro-abortion side has like no case, but really this is a Catholic school and I don't think they need to provide the counter argument if they don't want to. Like, they can provide the justification for their own beliefs and leave it at that.
Yeah.
If you want your kids to have kind of the pro-abortion side of the argument, then by all means, that's your right as a parent. And in this case, this is the responsible thing to do. If you don't like what the school is teaching, regardless,
find a different
school. Move it to a new school. And this is just a side topic. Like, this is a good reason for why school funding should follow the student.
Yes.
This is wherever the student goes, that's where the education funding should go, and leave it up to the parents to send their kid wherever they think was best suited for their child, for their beliefs.
Yeah.
No controversy. Like, this shouldn't be a story. Like, this isn't really a story. This simply is, I sent my kids to a Catholic school. They got taught Catholic things. I don't like that, so I pulled them out. That's the story. That's it. But of course, CBC has to blow us up as a big anti-abortion,
yeah,
shock and awe that this is being taught at a Catholic school. And so, like I said, there's so many more things that we can get into on this. And at some point, no doubt, the abortion issues will always come up in conversation and from time to time on this podcast. But this is just, if nothing else, whatever side you fall on, I think we can all agree that Catholics teaching about the sanctity of life, even unborn life, is not a surprise.
Yeah, it really shouldn't be.
No, this is yeah, fish is wet kind of story. Like, this is not a surprise. But this is where we live now. This is the kind of the day and age that we have to write articles on surprising things that Catholics are teaching, like Catholic things. And that kind of maybe feeds into the next article that came out this last week. And so whenever Easter comes around, there's kind of an abundance of polls that go out, or at least poll results that come out around Easter related to religion and kind of culture and society's view of the topic.
One of the few holidays that still retains a bit of a religious undertone, even in the secular world.
Yeah.
So obviously you get a lot of press and a lot of publicity on the topic of religion. Well, this year was even amplified because it lined up with, was it Passover as well as Ramadan?
Yeah. So,
so this time of year, religion was like all crammed in at the same time with their major holidays.
Yep. So this article is from Global News with the headline, "Canadians consider religions damaging to society," and then survey. So this is a survey, the opening paragraph says that many Canadians now believe Catholicism, evangelical Christianity, and Islam are more damaging to society than beneficial, a new survey shows, as people across the country continue to turn their backs on religion. A new Angus Reid survey released Monday has shone a light on the perceptions of certain religions in post-pandemic Canada at a time when religiosity is already at an all-time low. And so with that headline, and it's a huge article, I'll link to this and all the other articles we'll refer to at pendletalkradio.ca, but it's an extensive article. But at the in the opening paragraph there, it says many Canadians find religion harmful. But you have to scroll down. I'm still looking. Sorry. Yeah, continue talking if you guys.
Almost two-thirds of the way through the article before you get the actual numbers on how people responded to the survey. And that headline might have been slightly misleading. The actual numbers state that on a whole, however, 31% of respondents say that good that religion plays in society outweighs the bad, while 22% say the opposite. And then almost half, 47% say religion contributes good and bad to society in equal amounts. So the bad is actually it's still a high number, but it's 22%. And then a neutral is 47.
Yeah. So the headline is a little bit more provocative than probably needs to be, or should be stated accurately. Though, you know, like, especially when you, the argument against that though, is that on a historic level, to have 1 in 5 people say that religion is an overall negative to society, that's a shocking number. Even still, it's only 22% say that religion is a negative to society. Whereas 31% still say religion has some play, and as you said, 47 are kind of neutral. There's good and bad with religious, or religion in Canada. Kind of another stat that was kind of came out, and which is to me more shocking. Mm-hmm. Paragraph just above it says, when it comes to self-reflection, the survey showed that those who identify as religious are naturally more likely to believe religion makes positive contributions to Canadian society than negative ones. That's sure, of course, right? But it's not like when you hear that, like if you are a religious person, I would expect this to be, 80%, 90%,
nearing the total number. Like you would think that almost every single religious person is going to feel that their religion is in some way beneficial to society, or they wouldn't likely be a part of that religion.
Right. Like that's like, if you knew you're part of a group that was detrimental to society, you probably aren't part of it.
Yeah.
Yes, of course we expect people or religious Canadians to think that religion is an ultimate positive good for society. But here it says 2/3 or 67% of evangelical Christians believe they play a positive role in society compared to 29% of Roman Catholics. So get that 67% of evangelical Christians. I think that the things are positive, or that religion is positive. That to me is already a really low number.
Yeah. You're already saying 1 in 3 doesn't think that their religion is necessarily a good
thing. Yeah, and overall is a good thing. But then even the Roman Catholics, 29%. Like I'm hoping
that's a typo, or like that was meant to be kind of the reverse, that 29% are the negative ones.
I know.
But like, either way, you're still saying that 1/3 of the people that follow the religious practice don't believe that it is a benefit.
Yeah.
And that's not a good sign.
I don't know how to make sense of that 29%. Like, you got to hope it's a typo, but this is, the article's been out for weeks now,
And they haven't corrected it.
So it would seem that there's 29% of Roman Catholics think that Roman Catholicism actually is a good for society.
That's like, startling.
I'm well aware of the whole idea of Catholic guilt, but like this is like quantifying it. This is like, they feel real bad about how Catholicism has played out over these last few years. Mm-hmm. No doubt it's received bad press.
Yes.
Like from the sex scandals from 5, 10, 15 years ago coming out. And now with the most recently kind of connected it to the residential schools. Yeah, I think I'm not surprised, but 29%. Like, if I'm a Roman Catholic, I could at least say that those aren't real examples of what true Catholicism is.
And that's where I would give this, just to give it a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, it doesn't explain in here what the questions actually were in this survey. This article doesn't outline the details of the questions, so it's entirely possible that they are the questions are broadened out enough. Like if I were asked if all of the Christian church is a benefit to society, I know that there are several branches of it that I don't believe are a benefit to society. Yep. There's some that are not. Same thing under Catholicism. If you ask that question in the right way, I could see how maybe people would be hesitant to answer that it is a benefit because of certain publicity or press in the last several years. So giving it a little bit of benefit of the doubt, but it's still not a
both,
still not a thing or a positive thing reading it's this.
That's just really surprising. And like I said, it's so surprising, even more so when you look at the historical context of Canada. Up until the 1960s, unfortunately, I don't have the stats exactly with me. I'll have to look them up later. But I recall teaching church history through our church, and we got to the portion on Canada. And I was surprised when I came across this that on a percentage basis, up until the 1960s, there were a higher percentage of Canadians went to church on a weekly basis than the states. And yet, when we think of the two countries, Canada is this kind of secular, multicultural country, and it's the United States that are the kind of the religious fanatics down there. You go back just 60, 70 years, and it's us, the Canadians, that put the Americans to shame when it came to religious observance. It was like something like 90% of Catholics in Quebec up until, again, 1960s. Things shifted in the 60s. 90% of Roman Catholics in Quebec went to Mass weekly. Like those are just absurd numbers that just don't make sense in today's culture.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's from a different time, different planet even. The other part to kind of highlight the kind of this religious nature of our kind of history of Canada is that when we were founded in 1867, the motto that was adopted for Canada and still is from sea to sea. And that is actually from Psalm 72:8. It actually is a quote from there. It says, he shall have dominion from sea to sea and from the river unto the ends of the earth. It's a quote straight out of the scripture.
That wasn't done coincidentally.
No.
They chose that very intentionally.
Yep. Even the order, and then, so that was 1867. 1949, Newfoundland and Labrador joined Canada, the final province. 49. So we're only 80 years ago, somewhere in there, something about that. It's there, and they're founded in 1949 with the motto, which still is their motto: "Seek ye the kingdom of God." This is a provincial motto of Canada.
Yeah.
And again, this is a quote straight out of scripture, Matthew 6:33.
Yeah, there's no hiding that as coincidental or anything, and it remains to today. That I find that almost shocking.
Yep.
Given the culture of today, it's surprising that they've retained that. But
furthermore, in 1967, so what is that, 55 years ago?
Yeah.
1967, we have the establishment of the Order of Canada. So this is a high recognition for service to Canada, usually given to given to Canadian citizens who have accomplished some great things for the country. And on the coat of arms that is given, that is part of the Order of Canada, is a Latin phrase, and I'm not even going to try. Again, I'll put the graphics up on the screen at this point.
You haven't been working on your Latin?
No, I haven't. Shameful. But the Latin translates, "They desire a better country." Strange phrase. Except again, this is from scripture. This is Hebrews 11:16. "But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city." Like, it's embedded in this, and it's not that far, that long ago.
Yeah, that's not ancient history. That's not at the early founding of Canada. That's within a lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's a lot of people alive. We haven't completely swapped over Canadian citizens yet.
Yeah, it's not whole new generations past.
No. And then lastly here, just kind of run through this religious nuggets that have kind of been, or religious trail that's kind of found its way in. Is in the charter. The preamble to the charter, which was adopted in 1982, begins with the phrase, "Whereas Canada is founded upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law." Right there, the very first lines of the charter, "Whereas Canada is founded upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law." Interesting note, this is more explicitly connected to Christianity and God in particular, or just in general, than any word that you'll find in, say, the U.S. Declaration of Independence. There they refer to nature's creator, these inalienable rights.
But not the supremacy of God.
No, they don't mention, they don't use the G word at all. They only use the word God in there. They, like I said, they refer to us, this creator being, this higher being, nonetheless, like you can surmise what it is or who he is. But here in Canada, we have more explicit Christian reference, God reference in our own constitution than in the States.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is still surprising to so many people. And that kind of leads into our main topic of the episode, is the Canadian Charter. And so what's brought this to my attention, at least, was over this last week, I started seeing a whole bunch of articles about the Canadian Charter of Rights. And that was because on April 17th, the Charter celebrated its 40th anniversary. So it was on April 17th, 1982, that it was signed into law. And so what I want to do is kind of do a brief recap and then look at some of the kind of the ramifications and maybe the direction that we are going with the charter and the rights that are included in it. And so as kind of already mentioned, Canada started in 1867, as I'm sure many of you are familiar, with the British North America Act. And this was an act of British Parliament that basically set up the type and the structure of the government of Canada. So it kind of laid out who the jurisdictions, what the provinces are in charge of, what the federal parties are in charge of, what the judiciary is allowed to. I believe it had some references to Aboriginal treaties and that had to be adhered to. That was in 1867, but there was no Bill of Rights. There wasn't, you wouldn't be able to look at the Constitution and say, okay, here is your right to freedom, or here's your right to free speech, here's your right to freedom of expression, here's your freedom of religion, life, liberty, all that good stuff, all the things that we normally think of.
Yeah, it's more an outline of responsibilities. And where like you said, kind of the structure, where the structure comes from. It's not so much the individual, but more the corporate and governmental level.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. It was basically just to set up who is in control of what.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, that's up until 1982, the courts, that was the main role of the courts, was to make sure that the province wasn't stepping on the toes of the federal government and the federal government wasn't stepping on the toes of the provincial government.
Yeah.
That was the gist of the court system, which is just seems so weird now when you think about all the court cases that come across. The news wire now is all about kind of more social, cultural issues.
Yeah.
And that has to do with 1982. But before that, before we get to there, in 1960, Prime Minister Diefenbaker signed into law the Bill of Rights. And so this is where you start to see that language that we are familiar with. So in this Bill of Rights in 1960, it set out freedom of speech, freedom of religion, equality rights, right to life, liberty, and security of the person. These are all still in the charter, or still in the charter today. Interestingly, the Bill of Rights included the right to the enjoyment of property. That one is no longer in, that one was taken out of the charter in 1982.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting to remove that, at least that concept.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we've kind of talked about, we talked about that a little bit with a couple of episodes ago with tax policy and the, how important recognizing property is.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's interesting that that was pulled out. So that's in, so that was in 1960. And so leading, and so that was, but that was only put in as a federal statute. And so basically what that bill did, the Bill of Rights said, made sure that any law that was on the federal legislation or federal law books, as it were, had to comply with these rights. So right. The feds would write a law and had to make sure it didn't trump any of these guys, any of these rights. And but provinces were free from this. They didn't, the provinces and the provincial laws didn't have to match up with this.
Right.
And so it didn't have that same kind of constitutional weight. It was just another federal law that regulated other federal laws. It didn't have all the weight coming down on all the provinces. And so coming and so that's in 1960. Now moving towards 1982, it's interesting from 1867 all the way up to 1982, even though Canada was still was independent, we weren't really completely severed the ties yet.
Yeah.
And this is kind of an interesting fact is that even though we had our own constitution, we as a country couldn't change it ourselves.
Yeah, it had to go back to the British.
Yes. And so they basically rubber stamped anything. But the fact is that if we wanted to change our constitution, we still had to get British Parliament to sign off on it. And so, you know, there's still a bit of a leash there. There's at least a strand that hadn't been cut yet. And so, you know, if you really want to count Canadian independence, you know, thoroughly, we're completely cut off from our parents now. 1982, we might only be 40 years old, depending on how you want to weigh Canadian independence. But okay, so 1982 comes around. We have Senior Trudeau. So we have Pierre Trudeau in office. And he they go through the provinces, all kind of get together. They talk and hash out this new constitution, or at least... It really comes down to, it's an amendment to the 1867 British North America Act, but it's signed as we mentioned at the beginning in April 17th, 1982, by Pierre Trudeau, Queen Elizabeth, and just here's kind of fun little historical fact: Jean Chrétien signed it as Justice Minister. Yes, that's the same Jean Chrétien that would be Prime Minister throughout the 90s.
My childhood prime minister.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of the first one I remember.
The first one. Yeah. Of any memory. Like he was the prime minister when I was in elementary.
Yeah. This is. Yeah. 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 I don't remember Mulroney. Like that's just not, I think Mulroney was before him. I think it went from Mulroney to Chrétien. I might be showing my ignorance there, but I think that was right. It's close enough. But again, so this, what they were signing was the Canada Act, which again had to be passed through British Parliament. so this Act of Independence, again, just like in 1867, had to go through British Parliament to get our initial independence, our constitution. But then the final strands weren't cut until 1982, again, by British Parliament.
Not to say one way's right and one way's wrong, but there's a distinct difference between the U.S. fighting for their independence and us asking permission.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
It's a very different approach.
And yeah, it plays out in kind of the cultural psyche of the country.
Yeah.
It really does. And so, yeah, so that was signed 40 years ago. It's also the time. So at that signing, it amended the British North America Act of 1867. It renamed that to the Constitution Act 1867. It amended it with the Constitution Act 1982. And in part of that is the first section of that Constitution Act 1982 is the Charter of Freedoms, Rights and Freedoms in Canada. So that's so the Charter of Canada, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms isn't exactly synonymous with the Constitution of Canada. It's part of it. It's a significant part nonetheless.
Yeah,
but it's a significant part of it.
Yeah, it's almost like a document attached onto as an addition to it.
Yeah, so
what was missing from the Constitution?
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people there's debate around it in 82 whether or not we really needed the charter included in the Constitution. Yeah. Like we think of that as why wasn't it there from the beginning? For a lot of people, they didn't want it. One main reason is that, and we see this play out now, is because the charter is now included in the Constitution. It comes under the purview and the rulings of the justice system, of judges.
Ah, yes.
And so, prior to 1982, if you felt that the government infringed upon your rights or discriminated against you in some way, what you had to do was you voted for the other side. So you affected change through the ballot box. The courts had no jurisdiction on it because it wasn't part of the Constitution.
Right.
They're there to judge whether or not something is constitutional. And part of the Constitution before 1982 was simply the order of provincial and federal jurisdictions.
Right. Just making sure they're doing their job and not the other guy's
job.
Exactly.
Everyone plays their part.
Yeah.
And so, so if you had an issue with the government, you just voted them out. But now when 1982 comes around, now the legislation puts a law in place, and you find out now what you see more and more often is the judiciary, the Supreme Court, able to just dispose of it, say it's unconstitutional, and basically null and void it.
Right.
And that was the one of the dilemmas they had. It was whether or not we wanted that power in the hands of the judiciary, as opposed to the parliament. Now, one way around that, or one way that the provinces were kind of satisfied, or tried to satisfy the provinces, because they were concerned that their power was being stripped away too much, is that in the Constitution, I think it's in the Charter, I think it's Section 33, is the notwithstanding clause, which you might be familiar with.
Yes.
Basically, what this does is this is a cop-out clause. If you want a law that would violate the Charter, you just invoke Section 33. It's an escape clause.
Yeah.
So the judges come out and say, no, that law that Alberta or Quebec has implemented is unconstitutional. Basically, they're saying it goes against the Charter. Now, when they say unconstitutional, it includes the Charter. Yep. Before it didn't. So they say it violates the Charter. If the province really wants that law, they just invoke the notwithstanding clause and basically say, we don't care. We're not going to listen to you. This goes on the books. Canada, and the notwithstanding has picked up in other places, but this is one thing that kind of stands out between, say, the Canadian Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, is they don't have that notwithstanding clause in place. And so it gives, there is probably a little bit more rigidity to its, a little more weight to its, to its words. Whereas here, yeah, this is one way that things can, if you don't like the Charter or the ruling, you just nix it. It's just, yeah. And Quebec has done this recently.
Saskatchewan did.
Saskatchewan, yeah. They did it not too long ago. I forget what one is, but it used to be a lot less common use. But in the last 5-10 years, provinces have been less leery of doing it.
I think we've seen a lot more tension between the provincial and federal levels in the last few years. It's been ramping up where provinces are starting to push a little harder against the federal level. And so I think they're a little more willing to invoke this because obviously it's going to create tension. Like if a province says basically forget you federal level, I'm just going to do what I want, it's going to create some challenges there.
Yeah.
You're going to have a hard time swaying the federal government to do what you want them to do if you're the one that's using the notwithstanding clause.
Yeah. No, I think important to understand is that notwithstanding, I think, only applies to the charter section. So like the province right. couldn't use that to overrule something that is rightfully in the domain of the federal government.
Yes.
So yeah, it's not a blanket constitutional
yeah.
hand wave. It just applies to the charter, and the charter is where you find all of those rights that you like so much. let me bring that up. So yeah, some important sections. Section 2 is where you find kind of your main ones. It says everyone has the following fundamental freedoms: freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of thought, belief, opinion, and expression, including freedom of the press and other means or media of communication. Freedom of peaceful assembly, freedom of association. And then section 15 is another big one. Let me scroll down. Every individual is equal before and under the law and has the right to equal protection and equal benefit of the law without discrimination. And in particular, without discrimination based on race, national and ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental and physical disability. And the other, let's see, I think it was 24, section 24, everyone whose rights or freedoms as guaranteed by this charter have been infringed or denied may apply to the court or of competent jurisdiction to obtain such remedy as the court considers appropriate and just to the circumstances. So that was one of the key inclusions there, or at least key factors, is that now the courts get to decide this charter and the parameter of it. And I think here I'll insert there's the when it comes to the Constitution, and this is more kind of out of the states this conversation has had, but I think it applies equally to reading anything in general. There's this approach of either reading something as it was originally intended, or termed the living tree method.
Right.
And this to me is where the concern, like if someone reads the text of the Constitution as it was written in the time it was written and try to apply the principles that the original authors intended it to be, that itself is a restriction on the court. They just can't throw extra stuff in there that they like.
Yeah.
It's and no doubt, you know, when this was written in 1982, even just in 1982 to today, think about all the social changes that have gone on, how terms and
the meaning of words
has changed. Yes. Right.
If you're going to read it, you got to read it as they understood the terms and phrases.
That's the textualist or originalist view, the living tree approach, or living document approach, is that the text, this Constitution, is allowed to adapt and be read as a contemporary document. So whatever the current understanding of a word is can be put in there, or at least if it kind of fits in with the general principles of this. Even though it's not explicitly mentioned, we can read it into that because it kind of fits in. So just as an example of this, in section 15, where it says everyone is equal before and under the law, it lists out a whole bunch of things. It says that that there cannot be discrimination based on race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental and physical disability. Now, in today's... So when this is originally written in 1982, think about this. What does sex mean?
Male or female?
Even in 1982, you ask someone, that is the common usage of that term, common understanding.
Yeah.
There's no way that you can bring in someone from 1982 and ask them today, and there are still people alive you can do this with, who've actually signed this. Brian Peckford was a framer of this 1982. He's still alive. And he's actually suing the government on this.
Isn't he the guy that's a little upset?
Yeah, no, yeah, that's another topic. But just think about that. But nowadays, the government or the courts have actually read into this passage, and that term sex, things like sexual orientation, things like gender identity and gender expression. And yet none of that is in there. So that's a key difference between kind of this originalist textualist approach where you just read it as the original author is intended, what those words meant in their time, or we can kind of adapt it. We'll say that, yeah, that sounds good. You know, we ourselves don't want to discriminate against sexual orientation. It fits in with the kind of the general nature of this principle. So we'll do that. That's where the stretching of the courts becomes, I think, most dangerous, because sure. Okay. Let's say as a society, we want to say we shouldn't discriminate against sexual orientation. Okay. Change the constitution. Then you were concerned about the courts having too much power. Okay. You as a legislature, get your act together and change the constitution. The problem is that's an onerous process.
Yeah.
It's much easier just to let the courts read into the text whatever they want.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to go through all that cumbersome constitutional amendment stuff and all the trouble that's worth. You just get 9 people on court to kind of feel the sway of the culture, and they'll just fit that in there.
Just manipulate the language as you see fit, and you can make this say pretty much anything you want.
Yeah, that's probably the most clear example. But yeah, there's court case after court case where this is like I said, this isn't the conversation that normally happens in Canada. This is more usually a Canadian or a US one, where you kind of talk about whether the court is reading the text as an originalist perspective or as a living document perspective. That's not a conversation in Canada, because it's almost always been from the start read in this kind of living adaptive mode of a constitution. It's never really been a question. And we're starting to see the consequences of it now. Again, in the article or the constitution, right at the beginning says freedom of, section 7 is another big one. Where is it? There it is. Yeah, section 7. Here's the other big one. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, and the right not to be deprived thereof except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. So this right to life and liberty has been read in to and security of the person has been read to affirm the rights of abortion. So the abortion laws were struck down because they thought that this phrase, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, was enough to justify erasing laws that banned abortion. How you get there from this reading, it's not exactly clear. More recently, medical assistance in dying or assisted suicide. Again, it's considered a charter right, or at least let's put it this way. Your charter rights are infringed if you are prevented from these things based upon Section 7. These kind of words, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security person. That's not exactly obvious here. And partly because the whole phrase security of the person is interpreted so broadly, it's really been interpreted as basically almost anything that causes the person stress or indignity.
Yeah.
And that's what they mean by security of the person. And they've used that kind of definition so broadly to include things that are so clearly against the right to life, which is so clear to me. Like, you have the right to life. That means I can't kill you. That means nobody can kill you. It would include yourself. And even up until the 1960s or 60s or 80s, somewhere in there, we had on the law it was a federal crime to commit suicide or attempted suicide.
Yeah.
And no one had a problem with that. They got rid of that, and slowly the door has been opened, and things have been reread. And if you read the decision on medical assistance in dying, I think it's one of the few that I've actually read. I think it's Carter. I forget the other, Carter v. Canada or something like that. So in 1988 or 1989, there was a court case that was about assisted suicide that was actually shut down. It said, no, you don't have a charter right to that. 15 years on, court, the Constitution hasn't changed.
Yeah, the words haven't changed in there.
The words haven't changed. Same things. So the court is now reading, though, and you, if you read the court decision, they're actually, they look at, we have a common law system. And so what that means is you look at different case law. So other ways that similar circumstances have been decided. And in Canada, we don't restrict that necessarily to just Canadian cases or even just British cases.
Really?
You'll see them. They'll reference to things that are happening in the U.S. courts or how, the courts in Netherlands have decided. That factors in. Not everything is weighted equally, but it's a thing that the courts look at when making decisions. And explicitly, they say, culture and society has changed in regards to its approach to assisted suicide. And that factored into why the court flopped within a span of 2 decades.
Weren't we all told as kids that if all your friends were jumping off a bridge, you shouldn't jump off too? That seems like what we're doing. We're watching the way society sways, reading that into our constitution and saying, well, that's what we're doing now.
Yeah. That's how someone will take it for sure. That's just to give you an idea of some of the concerns and kind of the application of how the charter is applied. Yeah, I think there's legitimate concern about the power of the courts.
Yeah,
especially when they take such a broad, living document approach to this, they get to run quite free in how they read it instead of being confined by the Constitution and its original meaning and letting the legislature do its job and update the Constitution as culture sees fit. Like, yeah, I might agree that, times have changed and there might be some updating, but it's not the right process to go through the courts to do that.
Yeah.
You sidestep the very elect, the people that we ourselves elect to put in place there. That's the thing. They're concerned the courts, the unelected courts would trump the elected officials that are meant to represent us, the Canadian citizen.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the real concern. We don't vote in those courts. And so when things go a direction that we don't like, we have no control over that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's another article out by National Post that kind of highlights or wants to kind of highlight the case for perhaps putting a process in which Supreme Court justices could be removed from the bench.
Mm, yeah.
Because right now I think there's forced retirement at 75. So that's at least in the States, it's lifetime. You go till you die if you want to.
Yeah. Some of them,
they can't get removed. Up here, 75 is mandatory retirement. So there's at least that restriction, but otherwise there's no process by which Canadians have a say in removing court justices. And so this article is trying to make a case that perhaps we need to rethink that. The other element that makes kind of the Canadian charter unique, particularly when compared to the U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights, is that even though the preamble starts with "Whereas Canada is founded upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law," the very first section, so even before you get to these quote fundamental freedoms, before you get to the right of life and liberty, before you get to equal protection, the very first section of the Charter says that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the rights and freedoms set out in subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society.
So the very first thing done is to create parameters for when to apply these.
Yes, or at least ways and means by which these are restricted in some way, or can be restricted in some way.
Yeah,
this is a kind of a. It's not as strong as the notwithstanding clause. Notwithstanding, you don't have to show anything. You just say, I don't care what the court says. We're going to put this in. This here at least has the
demonstrably.
The facade. it's meant to. You have to prove yourself that even if you violate, say, the right to life, you've done so in a demonstrably justified way in the context of a free and democratic society.
Right.
So here's kind of an interesting comparison. This was mentioned again in another National Post article, but I think most clearly in an article by John Carpe. He's the president of the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. And he brings up the fact in an article, he begins this kind of comparison. He's trying to warn us of something. So that section one limitation sounds good. Like even in the States, they don't have that limitation, but even, you know, and so we think that, you know, this freedom of speech that they have, that they cherish so strongly, it's almost viewed as this kind of absolute standard, but not exactly. You know, they even down there recognize that speech that would lead directly to violence is not permitted. So, yeah. So you can't go and tell someone with a gun, okay, shoot that guy. You can't say that because it would lead directly to violence.
Yeah. And it's that whole, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater causing harm. You can't,
as long as there's no fire.
Yes.
Like that's the important thing. That's an important caveat that's put in there. Like, yeah, you can shout fire in a crowded theater if there's a fire.
Yes.
The key is, why can't you say in a crowded theater without fire? Because you know it will lead to harm, physical yes. harm of other people.
So you're causing a stampede. You're inciting harm.
Yeah.
To a group directly of people or to an individual.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
So even there recognizes some limitations to it. But this limitation, this free and democratic society, it sounds good, but I think we have to be cautious with this. And Carpe kind of points out some very interesting comparisons here. Reading from his article, it says the 1977 Constitution of the Soviet Union is only one example. He's talking about all constitutions claim to protect the rights and freedoms of citizens. And so the 1977 Constitution of the Soviet Union is only one example. As a workers' paradise, the Soviet Union, or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, was so wonderful that the communists made it illegal to leave and move to another country. Article 50 guaranteed citizens freedom of speech, of the press, and of assembly, meetings, street processions, and demonstrations. Article 51 enshrined the right to associate in public organizations that promote their political activity and initiative and satisfaction of their various interests. So this sounded great.
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
Like, I'll take this constitution.
USSR sounds good.
Article 52 guaranteed, quote, freedom of conscience, that is the right to profess or not profess any religion or to conduct religious worship or atheistic propaganda. Article 55 guaranteed the inviolability of the home. Quote, no one may, without lawful grounds, enter a home against the will of those residing in it. Article 56 exalted, quote, the privacy of citizens and their correspondence, telephones, conversations, and telegraphic communications. While Article 57 declared that the citizens of the USSR have the right to the protection by courts against encroachments of their honor and reputation, life and health and personal freedom and property. This is the USSR in 1977.
There's aspects in there that I wish were in ours. Like, yeah, there's certain things saying, in there, right? That sound really good.
And he says, it all sounds wonderful, of course, but the Soviet Constitution severely limited citizens' rights because it says in Article 51, quote, in accordance with the aims of building communism.
So they gave all of that, but then under the parameters of, as long as this supports the development of communism.
Yep. And yeah, another part, it says the Constitution, the US, he's talking about the Soviet Constitution, explained that the citizen of the classless communist society must be molded. Article 39 specified enjoyment by the citizens of their rights and freedoms must not be to the detriment of the interests of society or the state as determined by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Article 6. So that's, think about what it says. It's enjoyment of the citizens of their rights and freedoms must not be to the detriment of this interest of society or the state. Okay, now going back, I'll let you comment. Just going back to section one of the Canadian Charter. The Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the rights and freedoms set out in subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society.
So you get all these rights as long as you make the choices we want you to make that go in, are in line with what we want for our society.
Yeah. So So we think of this term free and democratic society is like, yeah, everyone, like, yeah, who doesn't want that? Like,
yeah,
we're all in favor of that. And yet more and more, you're seeing different ideas of what we want society to be. And still we could call it democratic in some way, free in some way.
Yeah.
Even this is brought out in an article from Ryan Alford in the National Post. And he highlights this as well, this kind of tension. We have all these rights on paper, but it doesn't mean they're always going to be there or always going to be there in the way that you think they're going to be. Like, just whenever I want the right to freedom or the right to life and liberty, I'm just going to claim that and say, here, government, you have to obey by that. No, if your claim to right to life disagrees with the government's demonstrably justified view of what a free and democratic society looks like, that doesn't apply anymore. You don't get that kind of right. So he writes here, that says, due to the prestige and importance of an instrument that has increasingly become to represent the national identity, he's talking about the charter, it is not surprising that it has become a battleground contested by those who hold fast to the idea that the Constitution serves to limit the powers of government, and those who see it as a means of empowering the government to achieve their vision of a just society. So there's two competing claims here. One is that the Constitution should be there to limit the government. The other one here says that people want to use the charter in order to use and the government's power to create and protect this free and democratic society, and use that power of government to enforce and cramp down on these rights because they infringe upon our idea of what a free and democratic society looks like.
So, yeah. So it's like they both view the charter as, let's use the analogy of like a weapon, but one views it as a weapon in the hands of the citizen to keep the government in line. Mm-hmm. And one views it as a weapon in the hands of the government to mold society into what they want.
I think so. Yeah. And you put any weapon in the hands of the government, that's a scary proposition, but we're seeing that, like, the last 2 years should give us pause.
Yeah.
If nothing else. And then ironically, when on April 17th, when the 40th anniversary is of the charter is being celebrated, Justin Trudeau tweets out his admiration and support for the charter weeks after he instituted the Emergencies Act, which basically subverted and trumped the right to protest, went in and used that to confiscate and freeze personal funds, rights to liberty. Like, there's still people in jail because of that.
Yeah.
So Alford continues on with this in his article, and he expresses his concern, really it's a warning about what happens when the government and the courts start to protect this idea of a free and democratic society over and against individuals and their rights. He writes in his article, it says, ironically, a judicial vision of the Constitution animated by the paramount values of equity and social justice gives the state back the ultimate power to decide the limits of every individual's rights and freedoms. It need only frame these limits as serving the ultimate good of democracy. That's the limit. That's section one.
Yeah.
This would only require the toleration of only the reasonable, or sorry, the wrong or responsible exercise of one's fundamental freedoms. The rights to freedom of speech, religious practice, assembly, and association, in other words, would only need to be upheld when they serve to promote the ends of social justice. So we're moving into this society in which these ideas of social equality, everything's equal, you only can say certain things unless they harm other people.
Yeah, that's
unless they distress people. And they don't, and that other person doesn't feel free.
If that's what you see as a free and democratic society, then that gives justification to revoke these rights at any time for almost anything.
Yeah. It's like this is dangerous. This is, like I said, they're written on paper, but this section one is as a dangerous direction if we're not careful with how it's applied. And he kind of continues with his article. It says, unfortunately, this approach to rights would eliminate the essential purpose of the Constitution. The Charter, like every other instrument worthy of the name, was designed to protect the vigorous exercise of all the rights that are necessary for us to preserve our democratic liberty. Without those freedoms, we cannot dispute and collectively determine the meaning of the public interest, which can only be defined by the public and not by the government. Any constitutional order that would allow the state to enforce a self-serving understanding of which freedoms should be tolerated would eviscerate responsible government and the rule of law. So think about this. If this idea of a free and democratic society is kind of the overall picture, like this is what we're aiming for, this is, or at least my conception as the government, this is what we're aiming for, and your freedom of speech goes against that, then I can't speak against you, and we cannot change. We cannot actually have a dialogue. We cannot debate what it actually means to be a free and democratic society. So if there's a government that this is where, you know, you might think that this kind of comparison to the Russian communist perspective and the Canadian Charter is kind of so out of line. That doesn't make sense. Think about what's going on here, though. If the government gets to decide what's free and democratic, and your speech violates that idea of free and democratic society, you don't have that right then to speak up. And there's no way you can actually change and debate publicly that notion of what a free and democratic society is meant to be.
Yeah. Yeah. You've lost all power.
Yeah.
At that point.
And that seems to go contrary to what every charter and bill of rights is meant to do. Protect the individual, even to extreme measures against the government. I would much rather a reading of the Constitution that errs on the side of the individual than the government, because once the government is kind of given favor, that's a lot of weight coming down on that side of the scale, and it can go down really fast.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, at the very beginning, this was always a concern about the Charter. We think it's a good thing that all these rights are protected in the Constitution, and in theory, this is good. I think if it's used in the sense of government or protecting the citizen against the government, what the problem is here is that based on Section 1, we're starting to see more and more the government enforce its idea of free and democratic. The courts, given their living tree reading of things, going along with kind of the common law, the culture, society, and the direction culture and the society is moving, using that to inform their decisions.
Right.
And you see the path we're going on.
Yeah.
What you thought were good and you know, inviolable, like they're called fundamental freedoms.
But how are they fundamental if you put a clause in that you can pull them away?
Yeah. And so this reminds me kind of you know, the whole iRobot thing where you have Isaac Asimov's three robot laws. And it's like, yeah, I agree with those. All those are good. And we look at the and then as the movie plays out, oh, I didn't read it that way.
And yeah, if you interpret it too loosely and broadly, then suddenly the solution is to eliminate humanity.
Yeah, you're protected by, yeah, it almost reverses its meaning.
Yeah.
And
that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, or at least, you know, it's not to be too alarmist about it, but it's certainly, I think, something that we should keep on our radar. Just because you can point to Section 2 or Section 7, Section 15, say, yeah, I have the right to liberty, I can say that if I want to. That Section 1 and the way it's interpreted, the way it's wielded by government and interpreted and used by the courts, that becomes a very dangerous tool that can actually undercut everything else in the Charter. And you don't be surprised when you wake up and the government says, no, you can't say that because that's against a free and democratic society.
And I think that comparison made in the Carpe article about the USSR is a relevant one. We read all the things they listed in their constitution there, and a lot of it sounds really good. It sounds like a phenomenal society. And then if you get on board with the idea of what the benefits of communism are, it still doesn't sound bad. And then you start seeing the way the government can use that to overrule all of your rights. And it basically just gives them carte blanche kind of power. You're just giving them complete control to do whatever they want.
So Carpe finishes up his article with some inflammatory language, but nonetheless, it's language that should perhaps may wake us up a little bit to the sense around us, lest we become too familiar with it. And the last 2 years, a lot of people have become familiar with a very top-down government approach. So I'll finish with this with his article. He says, "Our charter at 40 has not prevented us from moving rapidly towards a tyrannical system in which Canadians are slaves of the state. More and more, Canadians are managed and controlled by politicians and bureaucrats in ways similar to how farm animals are managed and controlled by the farmer. Ultimately, Canada's survival as a free society that respects the dignity of every human being depends not on the charter or on how the courts interpret it, but on the extent to which Canadians truly cherish our freedoms and are willing to suffer and sacrifice for them." And I think that's how I would sum it up, particularly that last line. The charter, as we see in the Soviet one, and as we see the tendency towards it here, just because your charter rights are written down and you can point to them, you can print off the PDF version of them, doesn't mean that's there eternally.
Yeah.
They're there only if you fight for them, if you have to suffer and sacrifice for them. We live in an age in which we just assume these kind of rights are there for granted, or just automatic.
Yeah.
We just assume what society would not live that way. Most of it, of human society has not lived this way. We are in a very blessed time, but there's nothing that says we can't change, that things don't go back to a more restrictive approach where these freedoms are indeed taken away, and taken away in a way that sounds good and justified.
Yeah, that's the worst part of it.
You don't need a Stalin or a Lenin. You don't need someone who says I'm dictator. Follow me. You don't need that for your charter rights to disappear.
Yeah, this isn't a martial law malicious takeover. It's just a gradual collapsing of our rights.
Yeah. Tell you for what it's worth. I think there's certainly something there to think about. Like I said, the way that it's formulated, the charter was put in there for good intentions, good reasons, and it has a lot of good things in there. Mm-hmm. These are rights that I think are God-given and should be protected, but there are rights for individuals to be protected, and as a means for the government to protect. The government is there to protect those rights for the individual. They belong to the individual. They're not there granted by the government for the government to take back whenever they feel like it. And so this episode is kind of giving you a little bit of history, a little bit of background to the charter and why we need to still cherish it, but cherish it in a way in which we actually protect the freedoms that are there and not allow it to be trampled as nicely as our government is, or at least acts it, or the good intentions that it might act in. Don't wait for a dictator to rise up and take over. That's not going to happen. Dictatorships don't require just one person. The whole idea of a dictatorship can happen even without one person in place. It's just the top down power of government that perhaps you need to be careful about. Make sure everyone stays in their God-given lanes of authority. But when they don't, it's important for the governments and all the other institutions to stand up against it and say, no, this is not where you belong. But I'll end there. I'll end my rant there. Hopefully this gave you some things to think about. As always, leave comments. I'd love to have more dialogue and discussion with those outside of this room. So feel free to leave comments on the Facebook page. I think there's you can email the show at hello@pendletalkradio.ca. And then we'll get that. I think we're always up on YouTube. So there's lots of different ways you can throw out your comments there, disagree with us. But I'd love to hear what you're thinking on this issue. This is a big topic. This is an important document that we need to be careful in how it's used. It's a powerful weapon. Be careful what hands hold it.
Yeah.
So with that, thank you for coming along with us. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.